Bro, the one good thing I did get out of Riverwood is I did end up, you know, meeting friends through there. And when you're in group settings, you realize you're not alone. And some of the stories you hear, you're like, I don't have it as bad as I thought I did. Some of these people really have it bad. And it kind of makes you not feel so alone. It's one thing speaking to somebody, you know, that yeah, they care about you, but they've never dealt with addiction or mental health. So, you know, they might say, well, just don't drink or just don't let it bother you. Why are you
Keep
so
your head up high.
emotional? Yeah. And sometimes my answer to why I'm so emotional or why I'm crying is I don't know.
Yeah.
I have no idea.
Welcome to the Most High Show, a show about recovery, spirituality, and all that. Produced, posted, and hosted by people in recovery who have strength and hope and want to share it with you. If you or someone you love is suffering, we want you to know you are not alone. This is the Most High Show.
We are live. Welcome to the Most High Show, made by and for people in recovery, a show about recovery, spirituality, and being human. Our mission is to provide impactful, community-driven media that informs, empowers, and inspires positive change. Real people, real stories, real life. This is the Most High Show. We have Katie on the ones and twos. Jason and Josie doing quality control.
J&J.
We have an in-studio audience. Sarah is here.
Hello.
Hosting. And our guest today is Kai.
Nice to meet you guys.
So let's welcome Kai to the Most High Show.
Thank you.
So, Sarah, do you want to set up our guest?
Well, Kai, we are very excited to have you on the show tonight. You drove over 2 hours to get here with us tonight.
Yes, I did.
Insane, but incredible, and thank you. yeah, so just tell us a little bit about who you are, a little bit about this record-selling stuff that you do. And
well, worked at the post office for about 25 years. I am a Navy vet, U.S. Navy. Before that, I did 4 years in the military living on a ship. Carried mail for about, I would say, 17, 18 years and got promoted in 2017, a supervisor. And been doing that up until last week when I retired and got separated from the post office.
All right. Congratulations.
So now I'm just trying to find my way.
That's awesome. Well, I know you wanted to come on here tonight to really talk about mental health and shed some light on navigating challenging situations, navigating some significant traumas, and taking care of yourself. So,
yes.
I mean, I think we should just jump right into it.
Yes, do it.
So you did share about being a Navy veteran.
Yes.
And before the show, you were telling me a little bit about some things that you had seen in your time there, you know, with, you know, in the military, not everybody gets to come home. So what, how old were you when you started your career in that?
I was a little over 20. I want to say about 22. Just had my oldest son, who's now 30. I was a cook at Pizza Hut, knew I had to do something different. So ended up, don't ask me how, talked to a recruiter, and next thing I know, I'm in boot camp staring up, laying in a bunk staring up at the ceiling like, what did I get into? Back in 1996. It was fun. There was some ups and downs. It really has you grow up fast. Made a lot of friends. Some of them didn't make it, but that's, you know, the name of the game with the military. You know, you take an oath to defend your country, and there are risks involved. But luckily, I did make it, but I came out with some scars, some mental scars. And it was rough. Went straight in there. I got out, I'll say maybe a month later, got onto the post office as a Christmas casual. So I was only supposed to work a couple months for the Russian and Bush of Christmas season.
Christmas casual sounds like such a fun term.
Yeah, that's
like I went for a Christmas casual.
Right.
Yeah. Every year is a big rush with the post office around that time, from about late November to early January.
Is it at all accurate to how the Grinch portrays it in that film?
Close. Okay. It's pretty close. So I was only supposed to be working for a couple months. Got out the Navy, had no idea what I was going to do. Just knew I had a family. By that time, I had another kid, so I had two kids. This is my first marriage. Had no idea what I was going to do. Went to the office, talked to the boss, was like, hey, you know, I just got out the military. I know this is temporary, but if you have something for me, I would love to stay. At the time, they didn't have nothing. He's like, well, you know, we'll see how you work. Go back to work, we'll see, basically. First one there, last one to leave, you know how that goes. And one day they called me in the office, was like, hey, we had a position open up, would you still like to stay? So I've always looked at the post office a little differently than most because of the way I got in. I looked at it as kind of a blessing, that they would even take a chance on me. So, you know, I always did the best I could to try to prove that they made the right choice. All in while, still dealing with kind of mental health issues that stem from the Navy. Lost my friend. Well, let me backtrack a little bit. The reason I got out the military is because my father was sick. So I got out in 2000. My father ended up dying in 2001. But he was very sick. He had diabetes, enlarged heart, a lot of things going on. Plus, I, you know, I didn't get to see my kids grow up from their early years, being in the military and traveling and stuff. So that's the reason I got out. But I used to talk to one of my best friends in the military. His name was Nahaman Lyons. And, you know, yesterday was 9/11. So, you know, they try to give you a bonus to re-enlist. And we were talking about where we were going to go. We were talking about going to the Pentagon. I think they were going to give us like $30,000 at the time, which was a lot. It's still a lot of money, but it was a lot of money back then, even more so. So long story short, he decided to go. I decided to get out. He was killed. He was killed 9/11. And every year around this time, I get a little emotional. So excuse me.
No, no, man, that's real life right there.
Yeah.
And you still feel it because, you know, that's your brother there that, yeah, that you lost. So
we're talking about 24, 25 years ago, and I still feel it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that, you know, we've had, you know, war scenarios where we shot missiles, and you think about women and children dying, you know, doing certain missions in the military that stuck with me, nightmares. Just, I have severe anxiety and severe depression issues. I take a lot of medicine.
Then when you got home from that, did you get any therapy or any support, or did you look into anything like that?
Back then, no. It's a little more easy now, but back then it was kind of a punk move to admit weakness when you're a man.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, you know,
yeah, because you're talking about 2000.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we kind of just dealt with it and, you know, bottled it all inside, which ended up being a lot worse for your mental health, because it all gets balled up inside and it gets to a certain amount and then it just explodes.
Right.
So it got really bad. It wasn't too bad when I was carrying mail, cause I just did my job and went home. But, opportunity came up to go into management, a lot more responsibility, a lot more stress. So when I started doing that, I think I started temping maybe 2011, I started temping as a manager. They call it 204B at the post office, where you kind of learn the ins and outs of management and you get experience. So when a job opens up, you can apply. I did it at the job I carried mail at, so everybody knew me. So it was even more tough because people look at you like, oh, you think you're all that now. You want to tell me what to do?
Right.
You was working next to me yesterday, you know. So it was tough. So I dealt with stress from that, all the while still dealing with mental health issues.
Right. So like when you're dealing with these mental health issues, it's kind of like there's not a lot of margin internally.
No.
Right. So then you add something like the stress of a job and it kind of takes you to the brim.
Right. Right.
Where, you know, otherwise person who doesn't have those issues, they can add the stress of the job and there's some margin internally to where it's like, okay, they can manage that. But when you've been kind of silently, really internally managing depression and anxiety and those kind of things, adding the responsibilities of a job takes that over the top.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I started developing a cyst on my head. It started off like one or two. The doctor told me it came from stress. To now where it's like all over my head, like it swells up, it pusses, it bleeds. It's hard to lay down on a pillow because it's open sores. So it's painful. That along with being a major anxiety, it's hard to concentrate enough to fall asleep. So I, you know, I might sleep for 2 or 3 hours and I get up, walk around, try to go back to sleep. And then all day you're tired. You feel nauseous because you haven't got enough sleep and you're trying to manage an office. It's hard. So the whole time, you know, I'm wondering whether I'm making the right decision. Should I go back to carrying mail? Opportunity came up for a permanent position in 2017. So I ended up getting hired. And about a week before I was supposed to report to my new location, mind you now, I'm still 204B at the old office. So this night I was supposed to close. One of my employees, she'd been working there for about a month. I won't say her name on here, but you can Google it if you want to. And she ended up being shot by her boyfriend. At the post office. I don't think I got off work till about 4 o'clock in the morning that night. FBI, everybody was there, Postal Inspection Service. The first thing they say when they walk in, like, who's in charge? I'm like, me, you know? Shit. So at this time my stress is like through the roof. And then you start questioning yourself, like, did I make the right decision? Am I made out to do this? More nightmares because somebody else you know has been killed.
Yeah.
Right in your face. You have to call her family and tell her she's not coming home. Mind you, they had a newborn. She's about 20 years old. I think her boyfriend was 20 years old. They had a newborn baby. So the baby's not going to see their mom or their dad ever again. So that kind of stuff goes through your head. So ever since that day, like, I really had a problem at work, managing getting really depressed, wondering if I made the right choice. Am I cut out for this? You already got employees trying you. Of course, they're going to try to get away with what they can get away with, calling out sick, all these excuses of why they can't do whatever. Meanwhile, you got to manage a company, so. It got harder and harder to do it. There's a lot of nights where, got chest pains. I still get emotional because I always wanted to do a good job. I always want, you know, integrity and success associated with my name. I don't like the word lazy, you know, growing up, I was taught you had to do stuff right the first time. We came from a household where you could wash the dishes, and if you didn't wash them right, my parents woke you up at 3 o'clock in the morning was like, hey, wash these dishes again. Mm. Well, I got to go to school. Well, you should have thought about that. You should have did it right the first time. And eventually, if you don't want to get up again, you're going to wash those dishes right the first time. So I learned to do the job right the first time. You know, if it takes a little extra, it's better than what you got to deal with if you don't do it right. So I've always been like that. Maybe I put a little too much pressure on myself. Maybe that's the anxiety. But I've always been like that. So I put a lot of stress on myself to do the job right. Meanwhile, the older I got, you know, I started developing more cysts. I started dealing with more stress. It got harder and harder to maintain.
And so throughout all of this, while it's all kind of just like building and building and building, like these sound like a bunch of major traumas that are happening, but not being dealt with. Like, how are you coping with it throughout those years?
I honestly was bottling it up, probably lashing out a little more than I should have at my family and my kids, until it got to the point where I thought about committing suicide. Ended up getting admitted the first time at a Riverwoods Behavioral Health. Stayed there, I want to say about a couple months. Got out, went back to work. This is back in 2017. You know, they help you deal with your mental health, how to build, you know, ways of coping with it. So it helped out for a minute. Was able to go back to work and forget about, you know, the whole murder and everything and try to focus on everything. So fast forward to 2022, I get subpoenaed to go to court for the hearing. Mm. I had totally forgot about, you know, any of this happening at all. I could even talk about it without getting emotional. I got that good about it. But for some reason, when I got subpoenaed to go to court, I got with a lawyer. It was like, let's prep for the trial. Started bringing up all these old transcripts, videos of the murder, actually watching the murder on tape, on surveillance film, and everything came right back. Excuse me. Everything came right back, and it hasn't gone away since. It's made it very hard to function, to the point where I woke up one day, I was having chest pains. So I went to the clinic. Like I said, I take a lot of medication. All my medication was at home. So I was like, let me go to the clinic and see if I can get, you know, a couple of pills to get by. Went to the clinic, was trying to talk to the nurses. And all I remember is that my sentences were garbled. I couldn't make a complete sentence. And then I remember waking up at a different location in a hospital bed. So later on, I found out that I passed out. That was back in December. So right before Christmas, ended up getting admitted to Riverwoods again. This time, you know, the coping mechanisms didn't help as good. I'm not trying to mess up this show, so I apologize.
Take your time.
Coping mechanisms didn't work as good this time. Everything just seemed like it was crashing together. That's when I filed for disability retirement from the post office, because I couldn't function my job anymore at all. It was hard to even get up and live.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense. It still is sometimes. You know, I'm on here talking, you know, hopefully I can change somebody's life and tell them don't hold it in. If you have a problem, be man enough to admit it, or be woman enough to admit it, that you have a problem, and get help early. Because the more you hold it in, you just destroy yourself from the inside out. So, you know, I just hope that I can help somebody, you know.
Yeah. Get so through. Your second visit to Riverwood, the coping mechanisms that they had taught weren't as effective. Have you found anything to be effective?
Still trying to figure it out, to be honest. I got out of Riverwoods in early January of 2025. I was supposed to go back to work then. I went back to work in June because I just couldn't get the nerve to go back. And luckily I did have the support of my upper management at the time, because I don't know if I would have been able to make it to retirement. I might've lost my job, you know, if they didn't understand. But upper management, you know, helped me out. They understood. And all I had to do was speak up. But you don't know that when you're going through it. You know, you're holding it in. You think nobody's going to understand. And we're living in a day and time now where it's more awareness to the issues that people go through, where it wasn't back then. So I am glad to where we're progressing, but it's still a lot of work to do.
Yeah. So once you spoke up and said returning to work it sounds like that'd be very traumatic, right? Like to return to the same building, the same systems, the same kind of whole thing, that's like you're exposing yourself back to this trauma and reliving it. But I guess when you first returned, you didn't say anything. You just thought you can get through this. You just push through. Do you remember like what it was when you returned and you knew that you were sensing this? Did you not put two and two together, or did you put it together and then just decide that you were going to try and push through it?
Well, at that time I had already filed for disability. So I had a pretty good chance of getting it because of everything that was in my file and everything I've gone through with the post office already.
Right.
You know, especially witnessing a murder on site.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff.
So that shit come by my desk. It's like,
So yeah.
They'd be crazy to be like, no, sir, you need to get back to work.
You're talking about 8-9 years. I could have went out then, but you know, like I said, integrity.
Yeah.
I tried to push through it anyway.
Yeah.
To the detriment of me.
Yeah.
But also, when I did get to the point where I said I couldn't do it no more, I think they understood. Plus I had a long medical history to back it up. So I think that helped me go back, you know, knowing that it was only for a certain amount of time. But then you deal with depression. Mm-hmm. You deal with your inner demons saying they're not going to let you out. This is just what you have to do. You got to pay the bills. You don't have a choice. So it was a battle.
Yeah. Yeah. And was there anybody in your life that you were talking to about this stuff?
My wife, my mother, and by then I was talking to a couple friends about it, because they start noticing, you know, you looking different, walking around with your head and sores, and they're like, hey man, what's going on, you know? And you know, they kind of force you to start talking about it, and the more you talk about it, the more you feel more at ease and calm.
Yeah.
And I still remembered all the coping mechanisms, which is how I got into music. That was one of my coping mechanisms. And I spending time with my grandson, who just turned 1 August 8th. I never thought I'd be alive to be a grandfather. So that was one of the blessings of my life. And it also probably is the reason I never committed suicide. Was I got to spend time with him every day. And I also talked about that at Riverwood. It was that time I was out for those 6 months. I got to spend a lot of time, his whole first year of life, I was pretty much home because I was out of work. So I got to, you know, watch him grow up and spend time with him, walk with him in the park. It was a blessing. It was a blessing. But I don't know who's spiritual, but God has a a funny way of sustaining you, and funny way of I don't want to say slithering, but funny way of getting into little nooks and crevices to keep you going.
Yeah.
And that ended up being a very big blessing that I didn't realize at the time. But one of my another one of my coping mechanisms was listening to music.
It's a good one.
Yeah.
It's a really good one. Mm-hmm.
So after a long, stressful day, my wife would tell you I would get off work, go into my man cave, close the door, and I would listen to jazz or any kind of soothing music to bring me back even to an even keel. Mm. And that helped out a lot. So that's how I cope with it until I finally got separated last week. Actually, Friday was my last day of work. Friday. Wow. Yeah.
All right. So this is within the first week.
Yes.
Yeah.
1 week today.
Yeah. And you didn't waste no time coming on to tell your story.
Yeah.
And like, here's the lowdown on the post office. Here's what actually happened.
I mean, the faster you come and talk about it,
yeah,
you might save somebody's life. If I talk about it next week, it might be too late for somebody.
Yeah.
So, you know, I want to get the word out. If you're going through something, please, please get help.
Yeah. Well, I think like you're pointing out some key things that really, because it is kind of like you are consistently managing this state of anxiety and depression.
Yes.
And so music being a way to calm yourself, right? And playing with your grandson, hanging out with him to be another way. And I think like, I know myself, right? Probably not to the degree that you, and I think that's the thing that people need to understand when it comes to things like anxiety and depression. Like it's a spectrum of it, right? And so somebody may have anxiety or generalized anxiety disorder or panic attacks, and these things kind of manifest in very different ways, right?
Yes.
And having to manage them on different levels, you know, and learning how to live with it, right? I think like one of the decisions that I made was to not get onto medicines. This is just my own choice. You know, as someone who was chemically dependent most of my life, I'm like, I don't want to be chemically dependent. So that the reality of that choice for me means I need to have holistic ways of managing that, right? And so music is one of my things I go to. And so there's this kind of consistent kind of managing of it and going up and down. And I think for whoever chooses how they need to manage it, right? Like I'm just saying what my choice was, how I chose to manage it. It's kind of like, you know, I don't want to say like, you know, like there's levels of existence that I'm willing to accept, you know, like, but it's kind of like that. It's kind of like it there's a saying of kind of like it is what it is at some level, right? Like yeah. This is something that I have internally. There's nothing wrong with me, but this is something I have to live with and deal with at some level. And what are the things that make me feel better? What are the things that bring me joy? Do more of those things is kind of how I've done it. Like, there are times we leave this show and I go, we're going dancing. I tell that to my wife. Or we're going to go sing karaoke because I need to do something that is loud and obnoxious to cope with the anxiety and that internal pressure that I've been keeping in the road all week, right? And it's there are days when it's like really hard and there are days when it's, you know, not so hard and I can manage it. I don't know why I'm sharing all that, but I guess
it's very relevant. I love it because it ties in. There's so many beautiful things you shared in your journey to where you are now. And I love that it's a ritual for you to go into that room and just listen to your jazz music and the piano music. We were bonding over that before the show, comparing piano songs. Like, do you know this one? Because that's something that I've been doing more. Because music is very much a tool I've always had as well, but not making it, but listening to it, because I have like 200 playlists on Spotify, because I won't delete a playlist, but I'll like make a new one for each thing I'm going through. So whether it's like I just need a playlist full of piano music, or a playlist full of like epic orchestras or whatnot, like that's what my vibe
is. How many death metal playlists are there though?
Look, that's between me and God.
And I know there's a Drake playlist in there too, I'm sure. Yeah.
There definitely is.
Yeah.
But it, you know, it's very much like there's songs that I remember like carrying me through trying times. And one of the things I also love that you talked about was your grandson. Cause a common thing that gets shared in like healing communities, whether it's recovery from anything, actually just recovery from anything, people are like, oh, well, you have to do it for yourself. It's like, yeah, but sometimes, you know, that's not enough. Like, I need a reason. I need to, because I'm not enough. Because I, you know, multiple times have tried to kill myself. Even more times have wanted to kill myself. And so it's like staying alive for me, getting better for me, not so much. That one doesn't make sense. You know, my brain is actively trying to kill itself, you know, but for my nieces and nephews, okay, yeah, like I can do this for them. You know, for my little brother, I can do that for him. And it's, on the hard days, it's other people that get me through. Opening up about this is the struggles, because it is really hard to open up about struggles, like big struggles, little struggles. You know, everyone has something, so why do they need to be burdened with mine? Whereas, you know, I never feel burdened when someone is sharing with me what they're going through. And at the end, you know, like listening to their story, listening to their struggles really helps me. It helps put perspective onto whatever I might be going through, and it's also like such a beautiful bond to have with another human, to be like, my soul trusts your soul and your soul trusts mine. Like that's incredible, and that's something that, you know, can bring you through on those dark days. But if you only do it for yourself and you just have yourself,
yeah,
what are you gonna do when that's not enough, you know?
Well, I think like some of the benefit of like us, myself being like in recovery, right, from addiction, there are plenty of groups and meetings and spaces for me to go into, and I'm sure that there are, and I think we'll post along with this episode a list of resources of meetings and gatherings and spaces for people who primarily are dealing with anxiety or depression. But I know that it's really easy for me to find a meeting and to find a group of drunks who are sitting together, you know, whining about their life. Mm-hmm. And I know if I go there and I leave, I'll feel better. And I think, but for people who primarily are suffering and dealing with and living with mental illness, that's not as readily available, mm-hmm. right? It's harder to find, like, where's a place where I can go and express this vulnerability and have this community? Do you have anything like that, or have you found groups or people that you can trust?
Bro, the one good thing I did get out of Riverwood is I did end up, you know, meeting friends through there. And when you're in group settings, you realize you're not alone. And some of the stories you hear, you're like, I don't have it as bad as I thought I did. Some of these people really have it bad. And it kind of makes you not feel so alone. It's one thing speaking to somebody, you know, that, yeah, they care about you, but they've never dealt with addiction or mental health. So, you know, they might say, well, just don't drink, or right. just don't let it bother you.
Yeah.
Why are you keep so emotional? Yeah. And sometimes my answer to why I'm so emotional, why I'm crying, is I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have no idea. There's times where I was at work and I just, you know, broke out into a crying spell. Chest tightened up, and you know, they're like, what's wrong? I was like, I don't know. Yeah. Or sometimes I'll be working and I'll just be crying, acting totally normal, but I'm just crying.
But you have decades of stuffing things down, you know? Yeah. And so like, if you ignore a feeling for so long, you'll forget what it used to be. But like, your mental manifests in your physical so much, and you shared on that, you know, with the chest pains, with the crying, with, you know, it being hard to get out of bed, all of these things, those are not just like you know, if your leg hurts, your leg hurts. You know, if you can't get out of it, you can't. It's very much like not just in your head. And so if you ignore those cues from your body for so long, you just forget. Like, I don't know. Maybe one point in time, but now I don't know, and I don't have time to unpack it with you.
Yeah. Like, I was an outpatient at Riverwood, and a lot of the people that were in there were inpatients. So I had the freedom of leaving after the daily sessions. I think they had two a day. So I stayed for the morning session, and I was free to go for the rest of the day. I could go home, you know, live a normal life. Some of these people didn't have anywhere to stay. You know, they had got their room and board and food from Riverwood. They had to go to two sessions a day. So it really caused you to appreciate, you know, what you was going through. I used to go home and talk to my wife and really close friends. And it was like, when I heard some of these stories, I was like, man, I feel kind of embarrassed to talk about my story because maybe I don't have it that bad, you know. So some of the people really had it bad. And, you know, almost when they get to you, it's like, well, I don't have an addiction and I don't have this, I don't have that. And you're like, wow, I am blessed, you know. Yeah.
See, I think that's so fascinating to me because what you've witnessed multiple times is something that so few people in the grand scheme actually witness. Yet, you know, like I never witnessed anything like that. But there was like in recovery, there was a shooting at one of my jobs. The guy didn't die, like watched him bleed out a little bit, you know, deeply affected other people I worked with. But I was just like, called my sponsor about it, like, you know, but people handle things very differently. But that's like the only thing that like, in my story that you could even come close to being maybe comparable. But I still turned like much less things. I was like, yeah, well, I need substances to numb this out. Whereas your coping mechanism never turned that way, which is so.
Yeah. And like, it's
interesting.
Right. Like, and there's no. Like, there's no comparing. You know, like, because trauma isn't what happened to you. It's what happened inside of you because of what happened. So what could be traumatic for one person. This is why, like, siblings who grow up in the same abusive household, one may manifest anxiety, depression, or addiction. One may not, right? And it's because even though they both may have experienced the same dysfunctional household, trauma is the thing that happens inside of you, not necessarily the thing that happened to you.
Right.
So, yeah. And, but I do, I understand what you mean by when you hear other people's story. And I think the thing for me is like, when I see that they're here, I remember early in my recovery that I was in an anonymous meeting and somebody was in there and their son had gotten murdered. And I remember, I mean, vividly that he's sitting there and he says, but I'm not going to use. And I remember his buddies next to him with their hands on his shoulder. And this is like, I'm like fucking 6 months sober. And I'm like, shit, there goes my excuse. I can never freaking get high because here is this guy who's in the meeting who has suffered the ultimate of, you know, losses, right? When to lose a child is the ultimate. And he's sitting there going, but I'm not going to use. I'm not going to go back. And so it took all the way. It's like, there's no excuse
exactly.
now. Exactly. Because here's this guy who's dealing with it. And I'd never felt anything as deep as that pain. Right. And I'd felt pain. And it doesn't belittle my pain. Right. It doesn't mean my pain wasn't meaningful because it is to me. Mm-hmm. But it is like good to know, like, if this guy can push through, then I can push through.
Right? Exactly.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you how many people, when we were in our sessions at Riverwood, was just so positive and so upbeat. Just something as simple as remembering my name, coming to a session. It's like, hey, Kai, how you doing today? How was your day yesterday? Like, you remember me? You know, who am I? You know, because, you know, when you're dealing with depression, you're thinking, I'm nothing. I'm not.
Yeah.
And just the somebody remember my name, like that just made, and then you hear their story and they're like, wow, why are you so positive and upbeat? all the stuff you've been going through, like, that's amazing.
Yeah.
It just got to the point where they was like, I'm going to take over the day. Today is not going to take over me. And that was their attitude. And I'm honestly still trying to get there. Sometimes you think you're doing good, and then, you know, something happened the other day with the politician shooting, which leaked on air. Yeah. And I ended up seeing it, and it brought back everything that happened at the job all over again. So when you think you're, you know, you think you're doing good.
Yeah.
And something random can just pop up and bring you right back to that place.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's the reality of healing. The reality of healing, like, people think healing is a linear journey, and the reality of healing is it's much more like a dance. You take a couple steps forward, you might take a step back, you take a step forward, you take two steps forward, you take three steps back. But I think the key thing is you just stay on the path.
Exactly.
And what I'm also hearing from you is, like, stay alive. If you stay alive and you stay on the path, then you won't see it. You might not see it over time, but I think what I usually tell people is, like, one day somebody might say to you, you seem different. And then you have the, oh shit, maybe it has been a while since I had a hard time getting out of bed. But we don't see it usually in ourselves. It's usually someone else will point it out in us. Like, mm-hmm. Oh, I noticed you've been really kicking ass lately. Like, and it's like, oh, that's right. I have been kicking ass lately, matter of fact, you know. But the point is to stay on the path, right? To keep moving forward, because even you may have ups and downs, that the journey of healing is kind of like compound interest, you know. It over time it will begin to pay the dividends, you know. I mean, I think I've seen that in your life. Like, you celebrated 4 years last week. Mm-hmm. And you had a shit first three.
Yeah, that's one way to put it.
Yeah. And then I saw you just stay on the path, though, right? Like, yeah. And then watched this kind of compounding interest of recovery, in a sense, kind of snowball into watching this last year for you, Sarah, to really come into yourself, to be self-accepting, to actually be who you are. You're turning into a real human, you know what I mean? Like, it's amazing to see, but you stuck through it for those first... Certainly the first two, right? Yeah. Really rough.
Yeah.
And that it compounded. And this last year, I know, wasn't perfect, but you've grown tremendously.
Yeah, where I can get out of bed now.
Well, not always easy.
Not always easy, but sometimes you just, you know.
Not great for art, but.
I don't know.
Oh.
Yeah. Different. That's a whole other topic.
Yeah.
But yeah, healing and art might actually go together.
Really?
Yeah.
So for your own experience, Sarah, like, do you see that as being true? Like, what I'm trying to explain?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Cause there's days, like, even though, like, how we just talked about, like, this past year, like, objectively is the best year of my recovery. Right. But I also experienced, like, some very dark moments in it. Right. But it was still a beautiful year. And that's not to say there wasn't, like, 3 months that just absolutely sucked ass, because there was. But, you know, when I look at, like, my absolute, like, rock bottom in life, and I look at my absolute sobriety rock bottom so far, you know, they were kind of the same thing. And, you know, and, like, at the end of it, it was like, cool, I just kind of want to die. Like, there's no point of continuing on. So if that's true for my using days, and it was true in recovery, you know, in my using days, I was like, well, maybe I should stop using. And then in recovery, it was like, maybe I should try something different. Like, maybe what I'm doing is just not working for me. But again, it wasn't, like, wasn't motivation I got from myself. I sure as shit did not do it for me. But, you know, I had family who wanted me around. And I had family who were like, hey, like, you just went through something really traumatic and really difficult. Like, how about you just come stay with us for a while? And I felt wanted. And it wasn't like, I'm going to stay alive because I, you know, want to. But it's like, there's,
you don't stay alive for the McRib? It ain't that good.
I've never had the McRib.
You've never had it?
No.
I don't know that I've ever had it. You ever had a McRib?
Oh, yeah.
I probably stay alive from my dad's ribs. Those ribs.
Oh yeah.
I stopped being vegan for those. Let's be for real. But yeah, there's definitely the ups and downs, but you know, it's just that whatever reason could get me through that day. And for a lot of it was just like, somebody wants me. And if it's not me, somebody does. And that's okay. That's enough.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I think like the vulnerability that you're sharing, you know, I think it's really refreshing, and there's obviously like more path for you to go. And you've just kind of crossed the threshold into a very new season for you, which to me feels very hopeful, right? To have some space in your life, to have some literal time on your hands to explore, to try things, to, you know, try new hobbies, to try painting, to try, there was something about records.
Yeah.
What's the records thing? Talk a little
bit about that.
Well, I got a record player for my birthday in March to help me cope with things. So I started buying records. I grew up with records, of course. Everybody did. And then it kind of went away, and now it's starting to come back.
Well, you and I did. I don't know if
everybody Yeah,
I definitely did.
Maybe
not.
Some of the younger crowd. But
I had a boombox. Started
getting into, you know, buying records. Went on this app called Whatnot. It's an online auction app where they sell vinyl records. And the more I looked at it, you know, and thinking about eventually retiring, I was like, hey, I think I could actually sell records, you know? So I started up a company called Coin Fresh Records, trying to bring fresh coins into the house. This is how I came up with the name. It's actually doing pretty good so far. Over 1,000 sales in a couple months. Yeah.
Wow.
So we're doing pretty good.
Is there a niche to it? Are you like rare records or?
I start off in every genre. Recently came into a collection of about 3,000 jazz records.
Wow.
So I'm starting to, of course, when you're talking in online auctions, there's a room full of people and they're talking and you're learning something. Like every show you're learning more and more. And I'm like, I'm kind of steering a little towards jazz more now. Mm. But you start learning about what's valuable, what's not, what to look for. But I have a jazz show, and I also have a show that I do on Saturdays that's pretty much a little bit of everything.
Oh, this is on an app called Whatnot.
Whatnot.
Yeah, I've heard about that.
Yep. Yeah, Coin Fresh Records on Whatnot.
Yeah. So you go live, and what do you hold the records up? You play them?
Yep.
All that.
Hold the records up, take them out so they can see the condition of the record. Sometimes you can play them. It's kind of like an online party. We're just up there having fun, man, and people are doing what they love, buying records and building their collection. And you're getting it cheaper than you would get at the store.
Right.
Instead of paying 30, 40 bucks, you're paying maybe 10 to 20, sometimes less than $10 to get a good vintage record.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
How do you ship a record to make sure it doesn't bend or warp or break?
They have special record mailers
that
are built to protect the record.
How did you learn this in the industry? Or did you learn this at the post office?
A little bit of both, actually. And it was a coup that I worked at the post office because most of my shipments go out the next day.
Yeah. Right.
So I would take them with me to work. And
nothing
really held me back from mailing them, and nothing's holding me back now because I'm retired.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Have you heard Miles Davis live at the Fillmore?
Yes. Actually, sold a couple of those.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have, you know, I make music, hip hop music, and I sample. And that record is so full of samples because it's just him and the whole band. But it's very, very abstract and a lot of weird sounds and things. And I have an old MPC 2000. You know if you know that mm-hmm. is. So I have an old MPC 2000. So I would just play that record and just wait for a little. There's like no rhythm. It's very. That is a weird record just to put on and listen to, because it's so not. There's no real thing to grab onto that's rhythmic because it's so changing. But I would sample the shit out of that record. That thing is insane. Yeah.
I was telling my wife the other day, I like, I don't know if you heard of Sentimental Mood.
Mm-mm.
And maybe. It's that song that da-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na. It was on the Cosby Show.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. Yeah,
so
yeah.
It reminds me of childhood a little bit, the innocent childhood, because I used to watch it on the Cosby Show, and it's also very soothing if you ever listen to it.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's was it Duke Ellington and Coltrane? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very soothing. That's one of my favorite jazz songs.
Yeah.
But if you ever have the chance to listen to it, it's nice.
Sentimental mood.
Yeah.
We'll be listening to it in the 97 Lincoln on the way home for sure. So you found something there, right? That you can do and hold on to and build this collection and having this space and finding joy.
Yeah.
You know, for me, it took years in recovery to find joy. Mm. It was hard to compete with cocaine, you know, like.
They don't tell you about that.
They don't tell you, like, they're like, go take a walk. And you're like, what? I'm trying to not do cocaine. I'm going to take a walk. But it took me a long time physiologically to literally find joy in other things. It just did. You know, I don't know if I burned it out or my dopamine receptors or something. It just took me a long time to find joy in certain things where I could laugh and I could really enjoy life. And I found that there are maybe a few friends that I have who I genuinely laugh with, just make me laugh, and will just be the inside jokes and those kind of things. And it took me so long to find joy again, you know.
Yeah.
I'm a pretty intense guy, so when I found joy, it was like, oh, that's, I've been missing that piece. So when do you feel joy?
Honestly, dealing with records, I've been more happy than I've ever been in a long time. I couldn't even tell you why. Like, I don't even think I realized it, how happy I was. I would be in the middle of a show and my wife would come in the room and she would just smile. And I'm like, what's wrong with you? And she's like, I haven't seen you that way in years. And I didn't even realize it. But it's like a chance to just get away. Some of the shows are 2 hours. We've had shows as long as 7 hours.
Wow.
Just forgetting we were in the show and just having fun and talking and shooting the S, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
As they say. And making money along the way. It's really awesome.
Yeah.
Now, will it last? I don't know. That might be the depression in me. But right now, it's taking up my time and it's really fun. Also, I sell used records, I sell new records, but the hunt of keeping the inventory full is also fun.
Yeah.
My wife calls it picking.
Yeah.
So, you know, we look at estate sales and online sales and auctions and just any way you can get, you know, your inventory in and try to make a book is fun.
Yeah. I remember that was a thing. You just go garage selling and everybody had records that they were selling because this was, you know, mid-90s, you know, people were switching to CDs.
Yeah.
And so the records were kind of just useless for a lot of people. And I have a DJ friend in LA, and if you were to go to his house, it is like just the records are everywhere. And he stayed true to the records forever. And then, you know, they have Serato, which is like a digital. So he spent months and months and months digitizing his record collection.
Nice.
Recording it into the Serato. And but I remember walking into his house, and I mean, it's like covering. It's,
oh yeah.
Yeah, it's almost like an episode of Hoarders, you know, like the amount of records that he had. Yeah. And I still have a big stack of them. And I haven't used the MPC as much, but I think now I might be inspired to. I still have the record player and all that stuff, so I might be inspired now to.
I have a 10-foot dining room table, and my wife will tell you that we can't eat on it right now because it's literally stacked. I would say a stack of about maybe 100 over the 10-foot table. Like, you can't even sit down. I got boxes on the floor all in the living room.
Yeah. But the point is you found something that you enjoy.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, relatively kind of a simple thing, right? Yeah, that's beautiful.
Yeah, for the first time in a Yeah.
Yeah, you're smiling the entire time. You're talking about the records and the parties and everything. Yeah. And it's just like, yeah, keep doing that, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
For the first time in a long time, it makes you look and say, hey, there's a future.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Well, I'll definitely be downloading Whatnot and Coin Fresh Records. So what we like to do is kind of, as we close the show, is we like to have our guests who, as we say, it is sitting in the seat of service, the decadent seat of service. And that's what you've done tonight. You've leveraged your pain. You've given it purpose, and you're sharing it so that it might help somebody else. So what would you say to somebody who may be feeling some of the things that you've felt and dealt with? What would you say to that person here
tonight? Like I said earlier, if you're going through something, you're not the only one, you're not alone. Seek help. Early, the earlier the better. It doesn't make you a punk. It doesn't make you any less of an adult man or woman to admit that you have a problem and you need help. All it's going to do is spiral out of control to the point where you can't handle it anymore. You might be able to handle it at first. You might be able to go take a drink and say, hey, well, I can stop when I want to, or mess with drugs and say, I can stop when I want to. But eventually you get to the point where you can't stop. And you won't even realize it. So if my advice would be to definitely admit you have a problem and seek help to try to fix that problem as early as possible. The earlier, the better.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you,
guys. We're glad you're here. We're glad you're still alive. Stick around. You don't know what's going to happen.
And this show was awesome, man. It just to have a platform to be able to talk to people. I can't tell you how many times I've fallen into depression, and I'm in a house full of people, but you think nobody's listening.
Yeah, I know that.
You know, you feel so alone. So just this platform is awesome, guys. You guys are doing a great thing.
Thank you. Thank you. All right. I'd like to also thank the donors, supporters, make this possible, and, keep coming back. This has been another episode of The Most High Show.